could have fallen so far from a Spider Queen's favor, Matron Vidalma put in, the sweetness of her tone doing little to cover the cattiness of her remark. But Matron Mother Quenthel merely smiled at her. It didn't matter, Bayenry knew, because the plan was in full execution, and the other three had bought in wholly. When first they had entered this abandoned compound in Menzo Baranzon's West Wall District, following an army of Bayenry foot soldiers and wizards and beside the Archmage himself, Vidalma Tlabar and Misri Mizram had both worn sour expressions. They had learned soon after the secret invitation the gist of this little adventure, no doubt, particularly since those invitations had come from Matron Xerath and not from House Bayenry, but had been sent in deference to the demands of House Bayenry. Through the maze of the complex's entry caverns, the four matrons had been greeted over and over by Bayenry warriors, dragging out the many rogues who had come into this place unbidden and without permission. None were supposed to be in here by order of the ruling council, but it was an ill-kept secret in the city that Houses Malarn and Barrison Dalarmgo used this place as training quarters. In a powerful stroke, then, Matron Mother Quenthel had struck a blow against both of those houses, the uneasy second house and the ambitious seventh. If Banry's choice of dining with House Fay Branch during the festival of the founding hadn't warned House Malarn to temper those ambitions, indeed, if the appearance of Lolf's avatar at the dinner, if the rumors were to be believed, hadn't done so, then surely this bold strike would make the demand crystal clear to Matron Jindia Malarn. And Jindia could not even raise her grievance at the next iteration of the ruling council, because this place, once the home of Malice Doerden, the birthplace of the infamous Drizzt Doerden, could not be inhabited or visited by direct and unambiguous edict of the ruling council. Until now, when the first priestesses of the four houses in attendance had independently confirmed to their matrons that this mission was Lolf's will. And so, by Lolf's will, and by Bayenry's power, House Doerden was cleared that day of vagabonds and secret militia. And so, by Lolf's will, in accordance with Lolf's demand, House Doerden was ready to be reconstituted. Minolin Fay noted the agitation in Mez Barris's movements as the matron swept into the room.
"You have seen the events of this day?" she asked, moving right to the point.
Minolin Fay nodded.
"They have not been secret about it.
Four houses striking together."
Minolin Fay shrugged as if it should not matter.
"The Doerden compound is forbidden ground," she said quietly and calmly.
"I note that Fay Branch was not invited to Matron Mother Quenthel's little excursion," Mez Barris said slyly. "House Bayenry pulls her allies in close in this time of upheaval, and yet there you are, alone and with a hungry and ambitious House Malarn watching."
Manolan Fay forced herself not to wince. House Bayenry had guaranteed its alliance to House Fay Branch at the festival of the founding, but indeed, the events of this day had not reassured Manolan's family.
"Matron Mother Quenthel makes more of a statement by those she did not invite, it would seem," said Mez Barris, twisting the knife a bit.
"As with your own."
Matron Mez Barris laughed easily and took a seat on a chair of overstuffed pillows just across from Minolin Fay.
"We refused her invitation," Mez Barris said. "They have more than enough force to expel a few houseless rogues, and I have better things to do than follow Matron Mother Quenthel on her ridiculous excursions."
A few houseless rogues, Minolin Fay thought, and didn't hide her knowing smile. Not so houseless, most, she knew well, and not a few of them were tied right back here to House Barrison Dalarmgo. Which was why, of course, there was no possibility that Matron Mother Quenthel had invited Mez Barris along on the assault, despite the matron's claims to the contrary. Mez Barris's lie revealed her fears, and thus her weakness, Manolan Fay silently reassured herself.
Do you think Matron Jindy Amalarn will attack House Fay Branch while the Bayenri soldiers are still in the field? Matron Mesbaris asked. Or will she wait until Matron Mother Quenthel's little play is ended?
Manolan Fay merely smiled. Not because she was confident that Mesbaris was wrong, but because even if House Fay Branch was wholly raised, she knew herself to be above the fray. Indeed, by Matron Mother Quenthel's private decree, one sanctified by the Avatar of Loth herself, Manolan was of House Bayenri now, the secret wife of Gromph, the expectant mother of the future Matron Mother of Benzo Baranzon. But of course, Mesbaris Armgo didn't need to know any of that.
"What are we to do about this?" Mesbaris asked, rather sharply, shocking Manolan Fay from her contemplation. "Do?" "Be not coy," said Mesbaris. "Matron Mother Quenthel has struck out against House Malarn this day."
"And against your own house," Manolan Fay interjected. Matron Mesbaris looked at her as if she wanted to lash out.
"If we are being not coy," Manolan Fay said.
The matron paused for a long while, staring at Manolan Fay hard.
"Matron Mother Quenthel has gathered her power together and is daring House Malarn to retaliate, but to the side. Indeed, she seems to be goading House Malarn to strike at House Fay Branch, and were that to pass, and were I to support Matron Jindia of House Malarn, Matron Mother Quenthel and her lackeys would not intervene."
"You have already said as much in fewer words," Manolan Fay dared to reply.
"What are we to do about it?"
Matron Mesbaris asked slyly, leadingly. Manolan Fay looked at her blankly.
"What are you to do about it?" Mesbaris clarified.
And after a few more heartbeats of uncomfortable silence, she added,
"We are allies, yes? Long have we planned for this inevitable day. Perhaps it is time now for us to seal that alliance, Barrison Delarmgo with Fay Branch. I can hold Matron Jindia at bay. House Malarn would not attack Fay Branch without my blessing. Not now. Not when Matron Mother Quenthel has gathered her allies so tightly about her."
"What am I to offer the Baelor?" Manolan Fay asked.
"Ere too was banished by a son of House Bayenri, defeated on a cold field in the world above. Surely he is not enamored of Tiago's family. You offer him the chance to repay Matron Mother Quenthel."
"Ere too is patient. Perhaps he would prefer to exact his revenge on his own, in time."
"You have spoken with the Baelor?"
Matron Mesbaris asked bluntly.
"Not recently and not directly. I cannot summon him, of course, since he is banished from our plane of existence, and I do not often travel to the abyss, particularly not to parley with one as unpredictable and dangerous as Ertu. I do not wish to find myself as a cellmate to Matron Kiorl."
"We have discussed this," an agitated Mesbaris said.
"The sword of Tiago Bayenri has altered our possibilities."
"We will go to Ertu together," Mesbaris offered. "We will bring the Archmage as well. Yes, it is time for him to assert control."
"Gromph will not go against Matron Mother Quenthel, not now."
"He knows of our plan. Indeed, it was his plan to begin with," Mesbaris argued.
It was true enough, Manolan Fay had to admit. The three of them, none favoring Matron Mother Quenthel, had indeed plotted Quenthel's downfall. With Lady Lolth venturing into the realm of the arcane, the drow wizards, even though overwhelmingly male, sought to gain newer and higher stature, and of course, none stood to gain more than Gromph Bayenri, the great archmage of Menzo Baranzon, the oldest and, by many estimations, the most powerful drow in the city. Perhaps Gromph would even be officially recognized as the patron father of House Bayenri. Such things were unprecedented, but then so were these curious and chaotic times. Mesbaris Armgo certainly would support the ascent of Gromph, mostly because her house would, in that circumstance, almost surely be elevated above House Bayenry, at long and deserving last. But also because she and Gromph had developed a mutual understanding over the past few decades. At least that had been the case, Manolan Fay thought but did not say. Unbeknownst to Mesbaris, much had changed in the Festival of the Founding. "Etu will give us Matron Kiorl," Mesbaris insisted, referring to the matron of House Oblodra, a drow family skilled in the strange magic of psionics. In the time of troubles, when normal magic had gone awry, Kiorl had tried to take advantage of her house's sudden imbalance of power, but alas, Matron Mother Evenel Bayenry had channeled the power of Lolth and dropped House Oblodra into the chasm known as the Claw Rift. For her insolence, Kiorl Odrin, Matron Kiorl, had been gifted to the demon Ertu, where she remained tormented to this day.
"Her hatred of House Bayenry is beyond sanity, and her powers..." "Yes, with House Oblodra a distant memory. Matron Mother Quenthal will not be prepared to deal with the bared powers of Kiorl. She will destroy Quenthal, and we will be rid of the witch."
Brigandierth's Kimuriel is said to be of House Oblodra, and quite skilled.
"He will never get to Quenthal's side in time," Matron Mesbaris insisted, so agitated now that she had dropped the use of the proper title for her rival.
Manolan Fay merely smiled. She had gone that morning for her first encounter with Methil Elvidenvelp, who was now, it seemed, firmly in the court of Matron Mother Quenthal. Even if freed and their plan enacted, Kiorl would not be nearly as effective as Matron Mesbaris hoped, Manolan Fay suspected.
"Gromph will not go against Matron Mother Quenthal," Manolan Fay said again. "Not now, perhaps never. And so our plan is moot." "We do not need him. You do not need him," Manolan Fay said. "If you wish to go to the Abyss to deal with Ertu, then may Lady Lolth go with you, because you will need her."
"Your house stands alone," Matron Mesbaris reminded her. "I am your one hedge against the wrath of House Melarn."
"My house? My house does not fear Matron Jindia."
"Fay Branch is no match for—"
"Fay Branch is not my house,"
Manolan Fay said, tired of the discussion and confident that she had learned all that she might this day. Matron Mesbaris stared at her curiously.
"I am Manolan Fay Bayenry," she announced, boldly standing. "Wife of Gromph, servant of Matron Mother Quenthal Bayenry."
"You dare?" an outraged Mesbaris cried.
"The Avatar of Lolth appeared at House Fay Branch in the Festival of the Founding," Manolan Fay explained. "It is not merely a rumor, Matron, it is the truth. And that truth has sealed a bond between House Bayenry and House Fay Branch. You might wish to relay that truth to Matron Jindia Malarn before she does something rather stupid."
Manolan waved her hand and cast a quick spell of recall and said,
"I go home."
The corporeal form of Manolan Fay seemed to fall apart then, bursting into a multitude of fast dissipating black balls of insubstantial smoke, leaving Mesbaris Armgo staring dumbfounded at this most curious, and surely most dangerous, turn of events. Chapter 7. Sufferance of Bayenry.
"Entreri,"
Beniago told Jarlaxle, in the drow's private room in the bowels of Illusk, a room magically warded from any unwanted intrusions.
"Not Drizzt, but Entreri and the others of that band."
Jarlaxle shifted his eye patch from his left eye to his right, humming all the while as he considered the startling report. Entreri and his band, sans Drizzt apparently, had passed Luskin heading south. After nearly 2 decades of complete absence, the group had returned. And this so close on the heels of the report from Braylon Jankay, a most reliable scout, that a woman, powerful with magic, and the curious halfling who had come through Luskin the previous autumn were apparently going by names quite familiar to Jarlaxle.
"Gaddy Bree and Regis," he said, shaking his head in disbelief.
He remembered when the two had passed on, when Drizzt and King Brunner had begged him to find them. Well, now perhaps he had, but with no sign of Drizzt anywhere, and with Brunner lying dead under the rocks in distant Gauntlegrim, or so he believed.
"They've been dead 100 years, Beniago replied,
though Jarlaxle had been speaking to himself and was startled by the response.
"You think it impossible?"
"Implausible," Beniago said.
"But then I find myself astonished that Entreri and his band of 5 have returned. Perhaps I have grown so cynical that nothing can truly surprise me anymore, eh?"
"Cynical?" Jarlaxle replied with a chuckle. "My dear Beniago, I would argue just the opposite. Believe in miracles, or in anything else that makes your day a better journey."
"And be ready for anything," Beniago finished with a wry grin,
one that Jarlaxle matched with a smile and a nod of his own.
"He would not come to Luskin," Jarlaxle said. "Likely he believes that I might still be here."
"Entreri? One would think him grateful. I can think of few fates worse than suffering eternity as a block of stone."
Jarlaxle's thoughts drifted back across the years, to the assault he had led on the castle of Lord Drago Quick in the Shadowfell. He couldn't help but laugh as he replayed that most enjoyable adventure. He and his minions had thoroughly thrashed the castle guard, as indeed Jarlaxle had thrashed the castle itself, enacting an instant fortress of adamantine right within Drago Quick's foyer. He could still see the expressions of a house guard. After the rout, Jarlaxle had gone to the substructure of the castle, and there had found and rescued Artemis Entreri, Dahlia, and the monk Afafrenfir, all 3 turned to stone by Lord Drago's pet Medusa.
"Perhaps the nothingness of stone was preferable to Entreri than the torment he feels in his heart and mind," Jarlaxle heard himself saying, but absently, for his thoughts were already moving to the present, to the revelation that Entreri was up and about once more. Jarlaxle didn't know why he cared so much, but he did.
"Where has he gone?" the mercenary leader asked. "Port Last," they said, "and the 5 are probably halfway to the place already," Beniago answered. "Dangerous road these days, though, so we cannot—"
Jarlaxle's laughter cut him short.
"I assure you that it will take more than a band of highwaymen to stop or even delay the likes of that group," he said,
and he was already planning his own trip to Port Last.
"Any further word from Braylon?"
Beniago shook his head.
"Drizzt, do you think?"
Jarlaxle nodded and muttered under his breath,
"Let's hope."
He looked up at Beniago and noted the High Captain's surprise at that statement, and indeed, Jarlaxle realized that such a sentiment must seem curious indeed to those who did not understand his own long history with the Doerden rogue, or worse, who did not understand what Drizzt Doerden had secretly come to symbolize for many of Menzo Berenzon's drow, particularly drow males. Perhaps Beniago hadn't lived in Menzo Berenzon long enough to properly appreciate that point. Interesting times seemed to be upon them, and Jarlaxle was glad that Camuriel was not in Luskin, or even this part of the world at that time. Jarlaxle's co-captain was off playing with his illithid friends at some horrid hive mind, which offered Jarlaxle great latitude in directing Bregan d'Airth, and in his own choice of roads. He thought back to his raid on the castle of Lord Drago, and could hardly believe that the attack had been his last real adventure. He looked down at his great desk, covered in parchment, in this, his private room in the Brigand Earth enclave, carved out of a subterranean ruin crawling with ghosts and ghouls.
"I have become a clerk," he said absently.
Beniago's laugh reminded him that he was not alone.
"You take heart in my misery?"
Jarlaxle asked, feigning upset.
"I laugh at the notion that mighty Jarlaxle would ever think such of himself," replied High Captain Kurth,
who was really a drow of the same house as Jarlaxle. Though Beniago didn't know that little detail about Jarlaxle's true identity.
"A clerk!"
Jarlaxle waved his hand above the piles of inventories, payroll records, and purchase requisitions.
"So give the records to Serena, or one of your other consorts or associates, and go out and kill something,"
Beniago replied heartily.
"I hope I haven't forgotten how to fight."
Beniago laughed all the harder and stood to leave.
"If you decide to find out, please do so with someone other than me, eh?" he said.
"Why so?" Jarlaxle replied.
"Perhaps you will defeat me and take over Brigand Earth in Camuriel's absence."
"I would hardly want that," Beniago said sincerely.
"And want even less to go to my grave at the end of Jarlaxle's sword, or dagger, or wand, or other wand, or giant bird, or enchanted boot, or belt whip, or...
Have I missed one?"
"Many more than one," Jarlaxle assured him. "Go to port last," Beniago said as he moved to the door at the side of the room.
This led to a small alcove and a circular stairway that began a winding path that would take him under the harbor and back up to Close Guard Isle and the Ship Kurth compound.
"You know that you must. The trade with the Zorlarans proceeds easily. The city is under our thumb fully, and I will be here when you return, with a smile, a pot of gold, and a bevy of lovely ladies to suit your tastes."
He tipped his cap and left the room. Jarlaxle found that he believed every word. Indeed, never had Brigand Earth run so smoothly. The trade brought enormous profits. The city of Sales was fully, if discreetly, cowed, tamed, and spider-webbed with an intricate set of new tunnels. And not a hint of trouble darkened any horizon Jarlaxle could see.
"No wonder I am bored," he said.
A lament he regretted as soon as he heard it.
"Are you indeed?"
came the response from the corner behind him, spoken in the language of Menzo Berenzon, and spoken in a voice he knew well, to his great dismay. On Close Guard Isle in Luskin Harbor stood as secure a fortress as any in the city, the squat keep and tower that housed Ship Kurth. Beniago Beanri, who was known as High Captain Kurth, was the most powerful of the five High Captains that ruled the city, as he would have been even if he didn't secretly have the forces of Brigand Earth supporting him, as was his predecessor even before Brigand Earth had thrown in with the ship. Ship Kurth claimed the largest fleet in Luskin, more than twice the number of foot soldiers as the next ship in line, and an array of allied magic users who split their time between Close Guard Isle and the haunted remains of the Host Tower of the Arcane on nearby Cutlass Island. The only land route to Cutlass Island, other than the secret tunnels Brigand Earth had constructed beneath the water, was a bridge between Close Guard and Cutlass. And so when the wizards had come to the city seeking to reclaim the lost glories of the Arcane Brotherhood, or at least trying to recover some of the secrets and artifacts from the ruins of the Host Tower, Beniago naturally invited them into an alliance with his ship. With all of that might arrayed around him, and Brigand Earth's deadly mercenaries in easy reach, Beniago walked easily when he entered his thick-walled keep, and took no note that there seemed to be few others about this day, which he simply attributed to the fact that spring had at last come, and the ships and caravans were being prepared once more for their travels. The drow paused in front of a large mirror outside the door of his private chambers on the squat tower's second floor, noticing his human disguise. "Not human," he reminded himself aloud, for he had taken to telling people that he was actually half-elven. He had been in Luskan for decades and had barely aged after all, as more than a few had noticed. To keep his human guise properly aging was too much trouble, the Bregendierth wizards had told him. So he was Beniago, the half-elf. "Good enough for them," he muttered, shaking his head. After all these years, the drow still hadn't gotten used to his body, his gangly legs and stretched form, his pasty skin that turned red at the first hints of a sunbeam, and particularly his carrot-colored mop of hair. Three keys disarmed the multitude of traps and unlocked his bedchamber door, and the High Captain pushed into the room. He would have much work before him, he knew. Jarlaxle was surely going to chase Artemis and Treri to Port Last, and Camoriel was not due back until late in the year at least. With that in mind, Beniago started for his large desk, covered in parchment more so than even Jarlaxle's had been, and with that in sight, he changed his mind and veered for the small hutch beside it, where he kept his fine and potent beverages. It wasn't until he started reaching for his finest bourbon that Beniago at last realized that something was amiss. He paused, his hand outstretched for the bottle, but his other hand discreetly seeking the fine dagger he kept in his belt sash. He caught the slightest of sounds behind him, a light step, a soft breath. He drew and spun around with practiced ease and the agility of a noble drow warrior. And his eyes widened, and he stopped his thrust mid-strike, trying to cover up instead against the coordinated strikes of a swarm of snakes. Beniago lurched and fell back, crashing against the hutch, bottles falling and shattering all around him. He tried to reorient himself to sort out the confusing explosions of movement. He felt the burn of poison. He heard the crack of the whip. He saw that these were not snakes at all, but the serpents of Loth's instrument. "You dare raise a weapon against me?" the wielder of that awful instrument scolded in the language of Menzo Berenzon. And the writhing swarm struck once more, the lightning speed of the vipers overwhelming poor Beniago. He felt curving fangs tearing at his cheek and a second snake biting around his belly. "Or has your human disguise overcome your mind at last?" the wielder yelled as Beniago desperately threw himself to the floor, thinking to scramble under his desk for some cover. "Have you forgotten your place, son of House Bayenry?" The words froze him in place. "House Bayenry?" "Matron Mother!" he breathed, and all thoughts of fleeing flew from him, and he prostrated himself before the priestess, and tried not to squirm as the five snakes of Matron Mother Quenthel Beanry's scourge bit at him some more.
"If you cry out, I will kill you," she promised.
Beniago felt as if he had been thrust back in time to his youth in Menzo Berenzon, where he had known such beatings as a matter of course. It went on until the pain and venom drove him to unconsciousness, but barely had he escaped that torment when the warm waves of healing magic washed through him, leaving him awake once more. Just as it had been when he was a young boy, beaten to unconsciousness, healed back to the waking world and beaten some more. He opened his eyes to find that he was sitting up in a chair, slumped but unhurt, and facing Matron Mother Quenthel, his great-aunt.
"Please me," she told him, bluntly nodding. "Yes, even though you are Iblith and ugly."
Beniago knew better than to look up at her, and staring at her feet, he saw her robes drop to the floor.
"May I speak? Be quick. I have not worn my true form in many 10 days, perhaps a year.
Beniago stammered.
"I can revert." "No," she commanded. "I am curious."
She walked up to him, cupped his chin with her hand and lifted his face up so he could look into her eyes.
I have great promises for you. Do not disappoint me, she said.
Despite the torment, despite his very well-grounded terror, Beniago knew that he would not. Eagerly, he stood up before Quenthel. Eagerly, despite the beating she had put upon him. Hungrily, because this was how he had been trained, with punishment as prelude to seduction, with supplication as beggary for pleasure.
And then you will tell me,
Quenthel said, pulling him close and biting his lip.
Tell you?
Everything, she said.
And she shoved him down atop his desk. Jarlaxle figured that in all of Faerûn, there were probably only a score of magic users or priestesses powerful enough to get through the multitude of magical wards he had spent years enacting around his private quarters, and maybe half that number who could do so without him being aware of the intrusion. Unfortunately for him, one of that select group was his brother, Grumph Beanry.
Well met,
he greeted, sliding his chair around to regard the Archmage.
To what do I owe this most unexpected pleasure?
My generous personality.
Jarlaxle nodded.
How fares Luskin?
Jarlaxle shrugged.
It is a wretched place of wretched people, so not well, I presume. But I fare well here, profitably so.
Fortunately so, I would say.
The gems and baubles flow back to Zorlaren as agreed, and to the coffers of House Beanry, I would expect.
Fortunately so. For you.
Is there an issue? Do tell.
I am sure there is. I did not come here to see you, but merely as a guide for another who is about within the city.
Yet here you are. Fortunately, no doubt, for me.
For another, who was at Ship Kerth, Grumph added.
And Jarlaxle had to work hard to keep the concern from his face.
Come to study the host tower's tendrils, then? To discern the important ties to the city now called Zorlaren?
No. Come to speak with Beago Beanry.
Jarlaxle sat back and tried very hard to look unimpressed.
It is not a name he has used
in a century or more, Grumph agreed. But alas, Beanry is a surname he cannot escape.
Do you plan to speak openly or continue in riddles?
Jarlaxle asked, starting to rise.
Sit down, Grumph instructed, stopping him in mid-stand.
Jarlaxle stared at the old mage for a long while, measuring the possibilities. Had it come at last to a battle between them, he wondered? There were many ways in which Jarlaxle could strike at Grumph in this room. Traps he could strategically spring, including no small number of disenchantments that might strip much of his brother's magical armor away. But no, Jarlaxle realized. His best action would be a swift retreat, and that too could be done with a mere tug on his earring.
The barmaid at the inn across the river is one of your lovelies?
Grumph asked, and seemed quite pleased with himself for having discerned that information, or even that there was an inn across the river with which Jarlaxle was associated.
A plaything, Jarlaxle replied nonchalantly.
Pretty for a human. Perhaps you will bring her along.
Are we going somewhere?
Oh, yes, I expect we are.
More riddles?
It is not my place to tell you.
Jarlaxle started to respond, but bit it back, seeing the seriousness in Gromp's expression. That last claim hadn't been some off-handed remark. The mage had chosen his words purposely and carefully. But who could claim a place above Gromp?
"When might I expect more guests, then?" Jarlaxle asked. "Should I prepare for a visit? Some food brought down for a proper feast of greeting, perhaps?"
"Just sit. And for once, dear brother, do shut up," the archmage replied.
There were times, as when he had first arrived here this day with Beniago, when Jarlaxle was glad that Camoriel was not around Luskin. And there were times when Jarlaxle truly missed Camoriel O'Blodra and the drow's psionic powers, telepathically relaying information to Jarlaxle from a different perspective and a deeper understanding, or with Camoriel preparing to discombobulate an aggressive wizard with a blast of mind-scrambling energy, or with Camoriel ready and prepared to instantly send a telepathic call to all of Bregendierf's allies. This was one of those times. An exhausted and battered Beniago Behenry sat in his room, contemplating the dramatic changes. Luskin was his now, and he had just become directly responsible to House Behenry for any failures. He wondered how Jarlaxle had survived all these years, with such vile witches as the matrons flitting around the edges of his domain. Jarlaxle was a master of deception, perhaps the best Beniago had ever known at that intricate craft. But how to fool a matron, let alone the matron mother, given their abilities to magically detect lies?
"I need an eye patch," the High Captain quietly lamented.
He tried to sort out Matron Mother Quenthal's sudden interest in Luskin, in Bregendierf, even in Atreri's band, and by extension in Drizzt. Likely it had to do with Tiago, since Tiago had made no secret of his desire to hunt down the rogue and claim his head as a trophy. "Yes," Beniago mused. Jarlaxle had gone to great lengths to keep Drizzt hidden away from Tiago, but hadn't that come on advice from Gromp? Beniago shook his head. It all made little sense to him, except that it was clear now that a power shift had occurred in Menzo Berenzon, one that had put his Aunt Quenthal in absolute control. Gromp would likely not be happy. He gave a resigned sigh. For what choice did he have in the matter? He was responsible now and in charge. The caveat to that level of power struck him, though, in his contemplation of his cousin Tiago. Matron Mother Quenthal had made it quite clear that when and if Tiago ventured to Luskin, Beniago was to serve him without question. He wasn't overly fond of his cousin. Indeed, Beniago hated Tiago, and he knew the feeling to be mutual. It was not a good day.
"Matron Mother,"
Jarlaxle said reverently, leaping out of his chair and bowing low, when Quenthal Behenry unexpectedly joined Gromp in Jarlaxle's private quarters in underground Illusk.
"Such the diplomat," Quenthal replied sarcastically.
"The surprised diplomat," Jarlaxle said, daring to stand straight once more. "Rarely does a matron mother of Menzo Berenzon venture from the city. Indeed, I am shocked that you are here, and more so that you have not brought an army with you." He paused and looked at her curiously. "You have not, have you?" Despite her grim aspect, Quenthal laughed.
"We leave at once," she said.
"A pity," Jarlaxle cried. "Do promise to return."
"We," Quenthal said again, and she accentuated the next word as she continued, "three, leave at once."
Jarlaxle's eyes widened. He even lifted his eye patch to let Matron Mother Quenthal see his shocked expression more clearly.
"It is a complicated place, Luskin. I have many duties to attend to and preparations." "Dear brother, shut up,"
Matron Mother Quenthal ordered.
This pathetic city is no longer your concern. You are being recalled to Menzo Berenzon.
Jarlaxle started to respond, but for one of the few times in his life found himself choking on the words.
Menzo Berenzon? The mercenary leader asked.
I need soldiers. Brigandierth will suffice.
For?
Matron Mother Quenthal's hand went to her scourge, and the five snakes came to life instantly, writhing around and focusing their flicking tongues on Jarlaxle. Something was very wrong, and on a large scale, Jarlaxle knew, and particularly unsettling was the behavior of his sister. His stupid, weakling sister. He looked to Gromph again, and the Archmage returned his inquisitive expression with the slightest but most definite of nods. Quenthal would actually whip him, he realized, to his ultimate shock.
Take us home, Archmage,
Matron Mother Quenthal ordered. Later that same day, Jarlaxle wandered the corridors of House Do'Urden in the West Wall neighborhood of Menzo Berenzon, coordinating 100 Brigandierth foot soldiers as they scoured the place of any remaining vagabonds and secured each of the entrances. He was glad that he had capable lieutenants around him, setting up the defenses of the house, exploring secret passages, and generally readying the place for proper inhabitation once more. Jarlaxle's thoughts were anywhere but House Do'Urden. He was glad when Gromph finally found him, in a quiet anteroom to the Do'Urden House Chapel.
How?
Who? He asked bluntly, both questions obviously referring to the strange and powerful creature that seemed to be inhabiting Quenthal's body. Gromph snorted.
It's a long story. She handled you fairly and with wisdom.
And I find that the most unsettling thing of all, Jarlaxle replied.
By Quenthal's order, to all looking in on this, it would seem as if Brigandierth had formally been hired by House Bayenry to prepare House Do'Urden. Indeed, House Bayenry was even paying Jarlaxle for the service.
All will be as it has been,
Quenthal had assured him.
To all of Menzo Berenzon, you are merely Jarlaxle, and your organization remains independent, and indeed, that is the truth, as long as you serve me well.
If Jarlaxle didn't play this well, he realized, Brigandierth would be absorbed into the Bayenry garrison, and everything he had spent his life building would come crumbling down around him.
You know it had to happen sooner or later, Gromph said to him, as if reading his mind, which truly, at that time, would prove no difficult task.
The eye patch might prevent such magical intrusions, but it could not hide the obvious. And Gromph was right, Jarlaxle had to admit. His life and his organization was in many ways a charade. Indeed, it survived because of that very fact. Forever on the edge of disaster, forever just at the edge of the sufferance of the matron mother of Menzo Berenzon. Forever just a power play away from wrecking that sufferance. Unless Jarlaxle wanted open war. In the halls of a place once known as House Do'Urden, the thought crossed his mind. Chapter 8 Spinning Dark Alleys. The drow crept up to the ledge, flat on his belly on the cold stone, and peered down at the road below, shaking his head in disbelief. This side of the small hillock was a straight drop, perhaps 30 feet or more, affording him a splendid view of the troop moving past him on the road below. Braylon Jankay had heard of Driz Do'Urden, of course. But seeing him now, riding a shining white unicorn with a horn of gold and a coat of elaborate barding covered in bells, bells that were silent now and obviously magically connected to the will of the rider, took the young scout's breath away. The rogue rode easily, very comfortable in the small saddle, and using the unicorn's long white mane as his reins. His scimitars bounced along at his hips, the diamond edge of icing death catching the morning light and reflecting it brilliantly. And the ease with which he carried a bow across his shoulders spoke of great skill with that weapon as well. And indeed, Jarlaxle had told Braylon of the bow called Heartseeker, and had claimed that Drizzt could take down a line of orcs with a single shot, or split stone even with the lightning arrows. That last recollection had Braylon edging back from the stony ledge just a bit. A huge black panther loped along beside the unicorn and seemed on edge, constantly turning at this sound or that. The scout thought of Tiago Bay-Henry. It was no secret among Bregendierth that the young warrior had been seeking Drizzt for 2 decades now, determined to claim the rogue's head as a trophy. The whispers said that Jarlaxle and Beniago had gone to great lengths to keep Tiago away from Drizzt, and now Braylon understood the wisdom of that choice. He couldn't imagine Tiago surviving an encounter with this one, to say nothing of Drizzt's companions even, for beside him rode the human woman named Catty Bree, astride a spectral mount, another unicorn and one she had summoned with a magical spell, a steed nearly as impressive as the drow's own. Behind them came a wagon, pulled by mules and driven by a young and ferocious red-bearded dwarf wearing a one-horned helm and carrying an axe that had seen many battles. Too many, if this one's age was to be believed. Beside him sat another human, one whose parents must have included an ogre, Braylon thought, given his great size and obvious strength. On the road beside that formidable pair rode the halfling, Regis, on a fat pinto pony. The troop bounced down the muddy road to the southwest, seeming a carefree bunch, though they were leaving the safety of 10 towns behind. Other caravans were forming in the towns, particularly the closest one, Bremen, on the southern bank of Mare de Walden. But those caravans would not leave without a full escort of at least 20 guards, Braylon had learned. Not at this time of year, when the roads were full of yetis and goblinkin and all sorts of beasts, ready to begin fattening up now that winter was at last letting go. Yet here they were, a group of only 5, depending on a slow-moving wagon riding into the wilds seemingly without a care in the world. Watching them, Braylon and Jankay hadn't a doubt in the world that they would get through the spine of the world safely. And Jarlaxle and Beniago would be waiting for them. He slid back from the ledge. Perhaps he could at last leave this forsaken place and deliver this last report in person. He'd shadow the group to their first camp, then go past them in the dark of night, and perhaps even get in close to the camp to see if he might find a bauble or two of his own. With a wicked smile on his face, the young Bregendierth scout crept back to the ledge and looked back to the companions, who had moved off. Something struck Braylon as different about the troop then, but he dismissed it as unimportant, until he realized that the Black Panther was no longer beside them. Sent home to the astral plane, he wondered. He had been well-schooled in the ways of Drizzt Do'Urden before being sent in pursuit of the strange halfling. He nodded, thinking that must be it, hoping that must be it. Then he realized that Drizzt Do'Urden, riding calmly and easily still, no longer had his bow slung over his shoulder.
"Likely a jackalope or wayward caribou," Catty Bree whispered to Drizzt as they plodded along.
Something had attracted Guinevere's attention, and Drizzt had let the panther run off. "Gwen will let us know," Drizzt assured. He turned back to the other 3. "If her warning call sounds, guard the wagon at all costs. We don't want to lose our supplies to a hungry yeti."
"Not a yeti," Wolfgar replied. "A yeti would have to be closer, or even Guinevere would not have noted it." You underestimate Gwen. You have forgotten Tundra Yetis, then? Wolfgar asked.
Aye, Elf. Ye ain't remembering how many times I pulled ye out from under one of them beasties when ye runned right into them, Brunner added.
Once, Drizzt admitted to the laughter of his friends. Only once.
I'm thinking an elf's only good eating once, eh?
Asked Brunner. Stay with the wagon, Drizzt replied. Wolfgar and Brunner laughed, and Drizzt turned to Regis for support, to find the halfling apparently distracted and not paying attention. Regis? The halfling looked at him directly, seeming startled. Stay with the wagon? Drizzt remarked again.
Back among that swollen pile of boulders, I think,
Regis answered, but didn't glance back, not wanting to tip his hand. Drizzt wasn't quite sure what to make of the statement, but before he could inquire further, a low growl echoed across the muddy plain of the melting tundra, and indeed, it seemed to come from the very spot Regis had indicated. Drizzt spun around and tugged Andahar hard to the left, the unicorn leaping off the trail and splashing off in full gallop. Catibri on her spectral mount paced him stride for stride, the two galloping hard and angling for the backside of the small mound of swollen mud and boulders.
"Drive them our way," Brunner called. "Bah, but I am wanting a good fight, I am."
"I had thought you in a fine mood," Regis argued.
"Em," Brunner argued. "What's your point?"
But Regis wasn't listening any longer. He noted the angle of Drizzt and Catty Bree's approach and saw a potential problem. He too whirled his mount and drove his heels into Rumble's flank, the pony leaping away.
"Here, where you going, Rumblebelly?" Brunner shouted.
"That's my pony's name,"
Regis called back, never slowing. Brunner tried to turn the wagon, but Wolfgar grabbed him by the arm, holding him steady and shaking his head.
"Aye, we'll be running with muddy feet," the dwarf agreed. "Like old times."
Brail and Jankay didn't notice the mounts breaking from the group. His attention was held back by the black form he'd noticed behind him, the panther stalking up the backside of the hillock around the scattered boulders. The drow scout thought to sprint for the trail, but realized the cat would surely cut him off. He lifted his hand crossbow and started to draw his sword. Just then, Gwenivar came more clearly into view, cutting behind a small tumble halfway up the backside of the hill. Braylon wasn't 30 feet above her anymore, looking down at her. He had underestimated the size of the beast. Braylon shook his head, wanting no part of that fight. Then he noted movement out on the plain, back and to the right, the two steeds charging along. The drow turned and jumped from the cliff. He heard a shout from up the road, but ignored it and concentrated on the situation at hand. He tapped his Brigandiaerth insignia, activating the levitation magic of the brooch, and his drop became afloat, caught on the breeze and drifting out over the road. He landed to find a new enemy close at hand, the halfling on his pony.
"Perfect," he said, thinking to shoot this one from the saddle and commandeer the mount, and up came the hand crossbow.
But the clever halfling fell over to the side of his mount, stealing the shot. Braylon growled and held steady and glanced back up to the cliff, expecting a giant panther to leap down upon him. He should have focused on the road ahead. The well-trained pony kept coming and even veered in a bit, and Braylon had to fall back a step to avoid being run down. He turned with the pony as it thundered by, aiming a shot at its low rider. But the halfling wasn't there. Braylon whirled to face a hand crossbow much like his own. The halfling had the drop on him and fired true. The dart hit him in the chest, and he staggered back under the weight of the blow and felt the burn of poison. But he was drow and well-trained, and Braylon brought his own hand crossbow to bear quickly. Except the halfling wasn't there. Braylon felt the tip of a rapier prodding at his back.
"Yield or die," came the command.
Drizzt studied the hillock as they came around the backside, picking a path to ride up. He kept circumventing the mound, though, and was startled indeed when Regis's pony appeared on the road to the north, riderless and galloping. Quick, he called to Catti Bree, and put his head down and spurred Andahar on. He caught sight of Guinevar then. To him, Gwen, he cried, and the panther roared and leaped back the other way. Andahar cut around the north side of the mound, and Drizzt caught sight of Regis, behind a drow, and holding his slender blade to the dark elf's back.
Hurry,
Regis thought, considering his friends. Despite his initial success, he wasn't thrilled at the prospect, or his odds, of holding a drow at bay. He holstered his hand crossbow and reached for his dirk. Sure enough, neither was the drow, who spun around faster than Regis could strike, a sword leading to drive the rapier blade aside. Regis was already moving with the turn, crying out and falling back. His rapier went flying from his grasp, and he tried to draw the three-bladed dirk, though what good that might do against a dark elf waving two fine swords he did not know. The drow came forward a step, and Regis fell away, but the fellow turned to the left, to the north. Regis, purely on reflex and purely in terror, drew not his dirk but a living snake and threw it out before him even as he fell to the ground. The drow didn't seem to know what to make of the quick serpent, which rushed up and around his throat like a living garrote. He turned back to Regis, even took a step the halfling's way, but then the specter appeared, the evil soul of the dirk. It tugged the snake garrote with wicked strength, so powerfully that the drow was thrown back into the ground, his swords flying, his boots coming right off the ground. At that same moment, something dark and ominous crashed down beside Regis, who yelped again and tried to scramble away until he noted Guinevar, leaping over to straddle his fallen enemy.
"Hurry," Regis cried. "Please, oh please."
He noted Drizzt and Catti Bree riding hard from the north. He saw Wulfgar and Brunner running up from the south, but he knew in his heart that his plea was not to any of them but to himself. He wasn't going to let the ghost choke the life out of this one, not when Guinevar had the drow under control. He rushed to retrieve his rapier and scrambled to the fallen drow, who was struggling to pry at the snake with one hand, his other arm thrown over his eyes in a desperate attempt to stop the great panther from raking his face off. Regis rushed up beside the fallen drow and stabbed down with his rapier.
"Rumblebelly!" Brunner yelled in shock.
"Regis, no!" Drizzt cried. But Regis wasn't aiming for the drow, instead prodding the leering face of the specter. This was the weakness of the garrote ability, he knew. A single strike at the undead monster, and it would disappear in a puff of gray smoke, as it did now. The snake released its choking hold around the drow's throat and died instantly. So half the drow's problems were solved, but there remained the little problem of 600 pounds of feline muscle standing atop him.
What?
Drizzt stammered, dropping down from Andahar and rushing to his halfling friend.
What was that? A rather pleasant weapon, don't you think?
Replied Catti Bree, who had seen this particular dirk in play before, on the banks of Mare de Walden. Drizzt moved over to look down at the pinned drow, the captive's eyes wide with terror. Guinevar kept her face near his own and opened her mouth wide to let him see her deadly incisors.
"Who are you?" Drizzt asked.
"Don't kill me, Drizzt O'Erden," he replied. "I meant you no harm."
"Bayenry?"
Drizzt asked.
"Breaking the earth,"
the drow answered. Drizzt looked at him curiously. He had heard this ploy before. Indeed, he and Treri and Dahlia had used it before, claiming to be a member of Jarlaxle's band when confronted by the Zorlarans and a noble son of House Bayenry in Gauntlegrim.
"Jarlaxle sent me here, following the halfling from Luskan."
The others looked at Regis.
"I saw our old friend in Luskan," Regis confirmed, "at an inn called One-Eyed Jack's, his tavern from what I could gather. I didn't think he recognized me. It's been 100 years after all, and—"
"Enough," Drizzt cut him short. Regis swallowed hard, likely realizing that he had probably just revealed far too much.
"I helped him, and the girl," the drow pleaded, "on the beach."
Again, all eyes turned to Regis and to Catti Bree as well.
The woman, looking confused, merely said,
I've never seen him before.
But Regis was already nodding.
The dart,
he said, looking to Caddy Bree.
The archer who was shot down into the sand.